Welcome to the NC Arts Cast. Today we're going to be talking with Ginger Wag, an artist who works in Orange County and Durham County and Wake County, lives in Carrboro, and you are an artist who works across many mediums. It seems like recently it's your concentrations are in dance, movement, and music. Is that fair?
Yeah, definitely. For the past 3 or 4 years, the slant has really been on movement productions that involve other mediums like live music and visual installation. But it definitely is coming from a base of movement and using the body and using the body to give information and inspiration and a way into the work.
You have a formal education in dance, including a BA of Fine Arts in Dance from George Mason University. And you also attended Wild Meadows Improvisation Intensive in Shellsburg, Pennsylvania. And from what I gather, Wild Meadows was an annual retreat featuring teachers from the Spontaneous Performing Artists Network. And the workshop focused on contact improvisation, improvisational performance, and developing site-specific approaches. Could you kind of explain what some of those concepts are and what your experience was like at Wild Meadows and maybe how it impacted your work now?
Yeah. Thinking about it, it impacted my work a lot. And even it's funny to look, to hear the name and to look back at that name and go, oh, Wild Meadows. And the umbrella I'm working in right now is called Wild Actions, and they have nothing to do with each other, those names. But even just that word and the connotation of that word, especially in performance, what it might mean, I think that experience that I had over 3 or 4 years, I can't quite remember, but I definitely went for 2 years in a row right after I got out of college. So I was 21, 22, and then went back maybe when I was 23 or 24. And it's a week-long intensive. And that probably had more of an impact on me than my college education in some ways. Although the dance education I received in college sort of taught me and showed me what I didn't want to do and what wasn't inspiring and what didn't speak to me and had me in a place where I could push against something, which is important actually to what I'm working with now and thinking about now and what I'm asking my collaborators to do. I think a lot of pushing is happening. So the education I received in college is great for that reason and maybe not so great for other reasons. So going to Wild Meadows with dance artists and improvisation artists who were maybe 5 to 10 years older than me, had established their own value system around dance and performance, had been teaching for a while, had been making work, had been getting grants. I mean, they kind of showed me this whole world that existed that I didn't know about outside of the stage, outside of really strict dance company forms. We were literally in a barn that had, you know, one side was completely open, three sides, you could see through the slats. There was still hay above us, big fields out beyond them. And this was our studio. So I was going from a studio in a beautiful, you know, building on George Mason's campus to this essentially barely a building, barely a structure in a field in Pennsylvania. And just that, just seeing a different view, seeing different elements when you are lying on your back or warming up or looking into someone's eyes, you can see the world beyond them instead of the dance studio beyond them. You know, just that can have a big impact.
So the walls literally came down.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And in a lot of ways, emotionally, they came down. I mean, it was a real open and imaginative place for people to, and it wasn't just dancers who were going there. It was musicians and writers. It was mostly run by dancers. So there was a large contingent of dancers studying there and practicing. But it was a mixed bag of people who were bringing, or a mixed bag of mediums that people were bringing with them. Yeah, I mean, we definitely did a lot of things that taught us how to be next to each other, how to be with each other, how to listen to each other. There were some deep listening exercises that we did, both silently and also talking. And we were living in one farmhouse and having meals together and cooperating in a tight living space. So it was a lot. There was a lot of learning and listening that was going on that also fed into our creative work.
So was the listening and collaboration element, was that not taught at George Mason? Is that kind of not a part of like formal dance education?
It might be in some places, but it really wasn't offered to me as a student there. I took a lot of technique classes. So there's a lot of listening and by students to the teachers, right, as there is in all places of education. But yeah, collaboration, not really a thing that was highlighted or offered. Yeah, I mean, it was a pretty tight program in terms of classic contemporary styles and then classic ballet styles as well. So it was conservative, for sure, in ways that maybe like VCU in Richmond was sort of breaking down those boundaries. George Mason was holding them up to be able to give their students what they thought was a solid education, which it is in some ways. But for someone like me who wants to push and wants to ask questions and wants to see, you know, what else is out there besides the forms and the structures that I'm being handed, you know, yeah, it was pretty conservative and I wasn't getting those things.
And what about composition and choreography and stuff like that? Was that taught at George Mason, or is that something that you got more at Wild Meadows? Or how did, because that's a lot of what you do now is right. Kind of like the big picture,
right?
Kind of, you know, it's choreography. Mm-hmm. You know, again, you're sort of playing with the form a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But did you get any of that there in college?
Yeah, some, for sure. There was definitely composition classes, choreography classes that we took. I was one of maybe a handful of people in my class to really choreograph almost every semester, because you could either be a dancer in someone else's work, which I was. The guest artists from all over the country came and set work on us. I was part of that. Also, choreographers from inside the undergrad program and the grad program were also making work. I was part of those. But then some of the undergrads also wanted to make our own work. So not only did we take classes, but we had the opportunity to, outside of classes, make work and present it as part of the each semester's, there was one show at the end of each semester where you could show your work. And I definitely did that as much as possible. So yeah, that was there. But again, in a very traditional sense, I mean, I was in school between 97 and 2001. And so this was a time of, you know, video had hit as an element in dance years before that in urban areas. But that was one element that was not even taken into consideration at George Mason. And that's just one element. You know, it's like, and one pretty standard element, oh, have a projection, make a video, have a projection, put it on the stage, then you have this whole other different backdrop and this different environment. And even that was a stretch for the department. And I, understandably, they just, that wasn't their wheelhouse. None of the professors or the administration had really worked in that form before. So they were really keeping us to the forms that they knew, and they weren't asking us to branch out and do other forms. But I did have that opportunity to make work, to get feedback for that work, to show that work. And so that, you know, that fire was really stoked pretty well. And that is something that I am super grateful for, because I found that I did have this need to be a maker of things. And even if I don't make things in that way anymore, you know, it definitely created this understanding of that desire, or at least the understanding that the desire is there. Maybe I don't even have an understanding of my desire to be a maker now, but
So some of the things that the workshop focus on, and these are things I pulled off, I guess, an old website, but the focus is on contact improvisation, improvisational performance, and site-specific approaches. And I want to talk about these kind of later on in this interview when we talk more about what you're up to now. Mm-hmm. But what are these things? Could you define some of these for us?
Yeah, so contact improv is a folk dance that was formed by Steve Paxton and a group of his students in the 70s. And pretty much it's about a lot of things, but boiled down, contact improvisation is about two physical points meeting and sharing space, weight, and time. So those points could be my fingertip and your fingertip, and they might meet and push against each other and then separate. That could be considered a CI, a contact improvisation dance. Or the point could be my head and the inside of your thigh, and we could stay there for 45 minutes and roll around and see where it takes us, and that's a CI dance. So it really, or it could be two people making eye contact across the room, jumping and flying and rolling through space, and they don't even actually touch. But the point of contact is the eye contact. So this form has really expanded and been studied by a lot of people. There are a lot of teachers who came out of Steve Paxton's original group. We did a lot of rolling around together, understanding weight and how to share weight, both physically and intellectually, conceptually. Improvisation, which is part of contact improvisation, is not having a set sequence of events that you know before doing. So just learning how to be present and follow instinct and intuition in order to either not do or to do. So sometimes a lot of improvisation for me is noticing an impulse to do something and very quickly, in like milliseconds or, you know, maybe up to 2 or 3 seconds, deciding if that is appropriate or not, if that inkling or impulse is appropriate, and then figuring out if that's not appropriate, what is, and then doing it right away. So it's as if we're doing, I mean, it's spontaneous choreography is the easiest way to describe that. And then, sorry, what was the last one?
site-specific approaches.
Oh, so site-specific approaches. That just, for performance, that means anywhere but on a stage. To me, some people could consider a stage in a site-specific way. And I think a lot of people have been really proficient and wonderful at that. But if you take the actors and you put them in the aisle of the theater, to me now it's site specific because they're actually not in control of the environment, and maybe the audience and the architecture is now in control of their environment. Or if you put them in a bathroom in a government building, that's going to be site specific, or in your backyard. Now we're in site specific zone. So, and those approaches that we took at Wild Meadows were really, let's take a walk in the woods. Let's understand what's around us. Let's really see what's around us and then feel how we relate to it. think that's a really important part of site-specific performance and approaches, is that you have to know where you are, and that matters. Because if it doesn't matter, you could be anywhere, and then in that way, it's not site-specific. It could be, you know, if you're in your own world and are plopped down in the middle of a field and you do the same exact, even improvisational dance as you would in a basement of a prison, then those things don't have any relation, or that dance wouldn't have any relationship to the space. And that's really what we learned a lot about, how to relate to our body in space, how to relate to other bodies in space, how to relate to this tree, how to relate to the light that's changing as the sun is setting while you're working for an hour in a place. So in that natural environment of being out in the woods, out in farmland in Pennsylvania, it really gave us an opportunity to relate to spaces that are usually quiet, that don't have a lot of action, and that you really need to take some time to understand how that affects you differently than being in your at your job or in an urban environment or on the subway, or, you know, because so many things happen in such quick succession in those areas. That I think the really wonderful thing about Wild Meadows is that we really took a lot of time to just notice what was around us, and not be too concerned with creating something, but letting what was there inform us as much as possible.
And some of these concepts, like especially, I guess, I'm thinking about contact improvisation. The way you describe it makes me think of a performance with multiple dancers. A lot of what you do, you may not be the only performer, but sometimes you're the only performer who's moving or dancing. But it seems like some of your recent stuff especially has involved contact with the audience.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
So you're kind of like bringing them into that experience. And so would that be also considered contact improvisation? Do you think about it that way?
No, not really. I do think that there's an agreement to participate in contact. So if the people involved don't know they're doing it, I wouldn't necessarily call it that name. I might say it's informed by contact improv, but I wouldn't say that it is that form. To me, that's more an interaction, a physical meeting, some kind of acknowledgement of space being closed or opened, you know, depending on proximity. But I think that form really, to me, it really is a folk dance, not too unlike square dancing. So there, it's often done in partners. It's often, there's a gathering that happens. So there's a time and a place, everyone comes there. And then there can be a facilitator who maybe is like a caller. So yeah, I consider that to be a more specific, maybe not closed, but definitely it has some more boundaries than an interaction between performer and audience member. Now, contact improv is used a lot in performances between performers. A lot of people have used it to as is, like just having contact improvisation performances. And a lot of people use it to inform partner work, like how to balance weight, how to do lifts, how to interact really close physically with someone else. So it's used a lot performer to performer, but not so much performer to audience member.
I understand about there being an agreement between the performers, like they understand that that's what's going to happen over the course of the performance. So when you are drawing on that physical contact with an audience, and maybe there's not an agreement made beforehand.
Yeah, there's probably never.
Right. So does that mean, is it like, is it confrontational in that way? Like when you interact with an audience and you're kind of like bringing that experience to them and they don't know, they maybe don't know that it's going to happen. Do you see that as confrontation, or is it something else?
My experience of it is confrontational sometimes. But most of the time I try to avoid that. Although a lot of people do feel, as audience members, the feedback I've received is that they do feel that it's a kind of confrontation. And whether it's an intense confrontation or just a hint of an approaching interaction kind of confrontation, I think I worry. I mean, that's something I think about and I worry about a little bit. I don't want it to feel uncomfortable, but I do want to encourage people to be involved in ways they haven't before. So it's a fine line between trying to encourage interaction, encourage physical contact, or proximity being closed between people, even if there's no physical contact. It's a hard line to try to encourage that and not push people away or make people feel like they're the center of attention. I think often if someone's feeling a confrontation, it can be because they don't want to perform. They don't want to suddenly now be the performer. And that's something I'm trying to understand and trying to work with and trying to figure out how to create an environment that gives people the chance to involve themselves without being watched in a way that makes them feel like they want to retreat. Because the retreat is not the point. It happens. And when that happens, you know, I embrace that. And I totally respect everyone's right to retreat. But I am trying to encourage people to move closer to one another, both physically and conceptually and emotionally. But right now, I am in a project called Reflex Arc with Chromie Bob, and we mostly perform in music venues, mostly perform on bills that have noise acts. We're already in a space where people are using confrontation in ways to push people. So in that project, I definitely feel, and with that crowd, which with those typical audiences, I feel like I can really confront people in the sense that confrontation is sometimes jarring and sometimes pushes you off of your normal state of being. And so I do that specifically in that project because I feel like the audiences can handle it and maybe they want it. And often we've had really great feedback and response to that. But with the work that I'm doing in other projects, I try to be careful about how to approach audiences and how to give them information beforehand and how to prime them to be ready to interact. It's definitely complex to not force people into something they don't want to do while still asking them and inviting them to do something they don't want to do.
Yeah, and I guess I think my understanding of what you're talking about is largely informed by music and punk and metal and noise, like genres that are meant to be confrontational.
That's right.
And so the audience that's going to show up to those gigs is almost expecting that. So there is kind of like that tacit agreement that you're talking, like the agreement aspect. Whereas if you were to do a similar thing in a different environment, you know, where maybe there's like, you know, it's a family show and people expect to be entertained and want to feel relaxed, then it takes on a different meaning entirely. And one of the things that you said in an interview, I guess a couple years ago, you were talking about your 2016 piece, And Always Why.
Mm-hmm.
You called it a structured improvisation.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of elaborated on that and said that the magic of the mistake is essential to what I believe in and want to accomplish. So what's the magic of the mistake? Like, what, I think I understand what that means, but how do you think of that?
Yeah, I really love those moments that we call mistakes. They are magic. It's like we never know what's going to happen. I mean, we can want to know and we can try to know, but you know, driving to our job or sitting here talking to you, we don't know at all what's going to happen next, right? So if we try to control it, try to choreograph it, try to create some structure for it, some of that will happen and some of that will fail and some of that will be a mistake. And so to catch those moments that are considered a failure or a mistake and embrace that makes for pretty honest work and pretty transparent conversation or dialogue between a performer and an audience member. And that's really, people who do improvisation, either musical or dance, you know, that's really, you know, we're just getting this high from not knowing what's coming next and jumping into it and looking for those gelling moments, those moments where everyone is agreeing and everyone's on the same page and the beats are right in line with each other and everything's kind of weaving together in this perfect way. I love that. I'm looking for that. Other improvisers are looking for that too. However, the mistakes in there, the failures in there can be really, they can transport us somewhere else if we allow them to. And I think that's something I learned from some of the artists that I met at Wild Meadows, who then we were all working together in different capacities in Washington, D.C. With those artists, we talked, and specifically Sharon Manser and Daniel Burkholder, we talked a lot and rehearsed a lot about how to own those fumbles, those missed connections, instead of trying to smooth them over, pretend they didn't happen. But try to really understand that those might be the most interesting moments where I have a footfall that isn't right. It isn't right because I didn't want it to happen in that way. And so it isn't right. But maybe what occurs in the rest of my body because I stumbled is really compelling, because there's no more... I mean, if you fall, that's kind of the most honest thing you can do with your body, because if you're not trained in falling, and I am a little bit, so sometimes I have to let go of that training. But you know, if you stumble and you fall or you almost fall, it's hilarious and awful and embarrassing, and you wish it didn't happen, and you look around to see if anyone was there. And when you do that in performance, it's just, I mean, I don't have a better word than honest and transparent for those moments. So I think so the magic there is to really allow interactions and how do I put this? It's almost like trying to read what's going on with someone else, right? You can look at their body language, you can listen to what they're saying, and you get an idea of what's happening. But in And Always Why, there was a lot of audience interaction, very specifically where we were trying to nonverbally get everyone to pass us a piece of paper or tell us where to go in the physical space or help us move things from one side of the room to the other, and or shout things out as a group. And I think that that reading one another, both the audience reading the performer, trying to tell what the performer's doing, and the performer trying to tell what the audience is going to do next, it's just fraught with mistakes and fraught with failures, and they happen so quickly, and you just have to catch up. And if you catch up and you listen, and then you fail again, and then you catch up and you listen, and it's all happening at once, to me, it creates this intense, beautiful web of emotional responses between performers and audience and space and time, and can really take us to lots of different places.